All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey everyone, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background, and I want to thank everybody for tuning into this podcast. Thank you for checking out all the other podcasts we're doing now. We're doing a whole bunch. We've got Luthier on Luthier for all of you who love hearing about how guitars are made. We also have the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, which I co-host with amp tech Skip Simmons. We have a brand new podcast called The Truth About Recording and Mixing, which takes that same exact formula and applies it to the world of recording, mixing, and mastering, whether you want to create a home studio environment or go into a real studio. It's a fascinating podcast. Our first episode just dropped with legendary Seattle guitarist Kurt Block. Please go check that out. And what else? We have a new partnership podcast with Breedlove Guitars called Acoustic Voices that I'm helping them out with. So we're taking all the energy that we used to be able to put into video shoots at our office with touring musicians, and all the energy that we used to put into doing things like the Fretboard Summit, which we obviously can't do right now, and we're putting it into the podcast platform. I hope everybody checks out our offerings, and thank you again for listening and sharing these if you enjoy them. So speaking of touring musicians, the Fretboard Journal, as you all probably know, covers a lot of ground. We feature acoustic guitarists, we feature electric guitarists, we feature mandolin players, we feature banjo players, the full gamut of fretted stringed instruments. If there's one constant that all of these very talented, very different musicians have, it's that they all own a Calton flight case. I know you know what they look like. Caltons can be very colorful, very rounded. They are sort of the flight case that everybody thinks of when they think of a flight case. But to be honest, despite them being a sponsor to a lot of the stuff we do, and despite them being pretty ubiquitous for anyone I know who wants to really protect their guitar or mandolin or banjo, I had never met Calton Case founder and namesake Keith Calton before, and I really didn't know his story. So that is the podcast you are going to hear today. Keith is a hoot, as you were about to hear. He is a personality, and I loved getting to know him. I think you will love getting to know him, too. He's a total tinkerer. He's now inventing other stuff now that he's perfected the flight case. And he is no longer part of the Calton Case empire. He has sold the company, and it is in good hands with Jeff and his team down in Austin, Texas right now. And we'll be interviewing Jeff in just a week or two as well, just to kind of close the circle and get the current day take on what Calton is up to. But I wanted to get this interview with Keith out because Keith is, like I said, you're going to love him. Before we get to that, Fretboard Journal 47 is at the bindery right now, which means that it's just about a week away from shipping. So if anybody wants to change their address, if you're a subscriber, now is the time to let me know. Shoot me a note, podcast@fretboardjournal.com. If you haven't subscribed yet and want to support the show and everything that we do and see what all the fuss is about with our amazing 128-page guitar magazine, please go to fretboardjournal.com, subscribe. There's a digital version or a print version, your call. Before we get to my conversation with Keith, shout out to a few sponsors. First up is iZotope. iZotope has these incredible plugins that will clean up your audio kind of no matter what audio editing software you're using, and can really fix glitches that would otherwise take you hours to painstakingly remove. I'll include a link in the show notes to a landing page where you can see what they are up to, but if you do decide to upgrade your audio editing software and use iZotope, use the discount code FRET10 and you will save 10% off of your purchase. We also are sponsored by our friends at RetroFred Vintage Guitars, which of course have Ry Cooter's teal Cooter caster still for sale. Someone, please, go buy that. Take me out of my misery. I'm looking at refinancing homes I don't even own to buy that guitar. I can't do it. I can't rob a bank. Please just someone buy that guitar. Give it a good home. Let Jason Isbell play it for a while. Whatever you need to do. They also have a 1973 Rickenbacker 480. That's the solid body, beautiful, weird, Gumby-ish red experiment that Rickenbacker put out back in the day. That's probably someone's birth year guitar. Check that out. They also have a 1967 Gibson A212 arch top that looks just absolutely stunning and a lot more. So go to retrofret.com. We are also sponsored by Folkway Music up north in Canada, Canada's premier acoustic and electric guitar store. It's run by Mark Stutman, one of our favorite people and one of the greatest guitar repair people alive today. So if anybody out there has a rare old Marden or Gibson and needs it to be taken care of by one of the very best, send it up there. You will not regret it. Folkwaymusic.com. We also, of course, are sponsored by our friends at Mono. Mono has an entire lineup of gig bags and studio monitor stands, pedal board bags, you name it. They are some of the most ergonomic and lightweight and well-built guitar cases around. And we can't thank them enough for all that they do. So go to monocreators.com. Those are all my announcements. I want to keep it short so that you guys can enjoy the rest of this interview with, again, a true visionary in the world of fretted instruments, someone who has saved innumerable instruments over the years, and somebody who is, as you're about to find out, quite a personality. Keith Calton, the founder of Calton Cases. Calton, as I said before, is now based in Austin, Texas, under new ownership. They are doing great, but this is the guy who started it all. Keith, thank you for talking to us on the Fretboard Journal podcast. Your name is synonymous with these flight cases that are loved around the world. Every touring musician I know seemingly has at least a few of them protecting their favorite guitars. But I know this, your history goes way back and these cases go way back. Talk to me about where you grew up and how you stumbled upon this unique facet of the industry that you ended up in.
Actually grew up, that's assuming I ever had. I was born in Southampton, someone has to be, and it was all right. Moved to Aldershot when I was seven, did the usual school things, couldn't get on in school. They thought I was educationally subnormal until I took an intelligence test when I was seven. And from then on, they laid into me because basically I wouldn't learn. I wasn't interested. And so they thought that using a cane would be okay. Well, to be honest, that never scarred me or anything like that. But they don't realize it was like Churchill. He said, if only they would ask questions about things that I know rather than things that I don't know. I'd have gotten very much, because Churchill wasn't very good at it. Not that I'm putting myself up with Churchill, but that was just something that came up. I wasn't very good at school. I picked up things not by learning, just by osmosis. Then went to be, I had no idea what to do. And so I went to be a mechanic. Which was supposed to be very difficult to get an apprenticeship, but I walked down the road to a garage I'd heard of that was good and said, can I be a mechanic? And they said, no. So I said, oh, why not? Because you're not registered in this town. So I walked down the road, registered, came back and said, now can I be a mechanic? They said, oh, all right then. And then for some reason, they thought that was, well, anyway. So I did that for a few years, did all the exams I could in that. And got some management stuff, but was bored stiff, really. I didn't want to touch another car. Well, I do now. I work on cars a bit. But did the India trip, as we often did. And when I was 19, 20, I went, managed to con my way onto an expedition to Spitsbergen and got as the engineer with Cambridge University. And that was a strange setup. But it was... it was interesting, and we did basically all the people that were supposed to do magnetometer surveying did the boat work, and I did some of their stuff and knocked rocks and that sort of thing. It was good fun.
Well, wait, where was this? I'm not familiar.
Spitsbergen, Svalbard. It's about as far north as it's in the protectorate of Norway, I think. It's up in the Arctic. And we went up in the summer. It was cool some of the time. And had a few interesting adventures with sharks and that sort of thing, but that's another story. And only one adventure with a shark. But
feel free to tell any adventures. It's open.
Well,
format.
It's just, well, we had a problem with the boat, which was 10 meter or 30 feet foot boat with a little Saab engine in it. It's not Saab, it's Saab, S-A-B-B. Lovely little tonk-tonk little motors. And we had, it hadn't been lubricated properly on the prop shaft, so we found it had, it seized up. So we pulled, had to pull it out of the water. So we borrowed a French expedition's railway line that went into the water, got our boat onto that, and managed to, after a lot of tribulations, hauled it out. But before we could, I had to walk down to the end of the railway line to the trolley, because the trolley we were going to use had posts on it. And I got on that, and I was up to my thighs in ice cold water, and I had waders on, so it was just up to the naughty bits. And I looked down at the pole that I was standing next to, and there's this damn great shark was rubbing itself on the pole. I thought, I hope he doesn't mistake me for a seal. You know, being in, so I didn't move very much. And it sort of eventually went away, but it was speckled. I still don't know what kind of shark it was, but I thought maybe it was a basking shark. It was only about 8 feet long, but that was bad enough to give you a nasty nibble, but I wasn't too worried. And then I saw the same shark later on. The Norwegians, the Nords, had killed this seal, and they left it. They left the skin on the water, or the carcass on the waterline, tide line. And the shark was coming out halfway through the water, grabbing bits of the insides of this poor old seal that had been killed. So I realized that it was actually carnivorous. But by that time, I was well out of the water, so I didn't go back in again. But we did get the boat out. I got some bits up from Norway, and we repaired it and got it back in the water. Had two 36-hour days on the trot, because there's no, obviously, it's daylight all the time. And that's before we knew about body rhythms and this sort of thing. It was interesting. It was nice. But I was, as I say, I was about 20 and came back from there, did another job. I sold brushes for a little bit, but realized I could sell anything without any problem. But I just didn't like it, because I was selling it to people and I didn't want to take stuff back to them that I'd sold them that I found out they really couldn't afford. So I left that job after about 2 or 3 weeks. And then I went down to, with some friends of mine, to Bristol, and I was near living in Aldershot with my parents at the time. Went down and visited a mate of mine with my girlfriend at the time, and we had trying to decide what to do. I wanted to make something with glass fiber, or fiberglass, depending on what you want to call it. And a friend of mine suggested, looked around, because they were all musicians down there, and he had this beautiful old Gibson, no, it was a Guild guitar, 12-string guitar, in a case that was made of bits of paper and cardboard and held together with roadie tape and wire and anything else. And he said, can you do something better than that? And I said, yeah, I think I can. And that's when the idea was born. And came back to Aldershot, or I drew around every guitar I could find, and to make a composite to find out what an average size was and this sort of thing. Came back and started from there on my father's floor of his garage, and ended up with a shape, because you start with what you want to achieve in the way of what it's got to contain, and then you put the aesthetics on the top of that and the shapes of the lids and this sort of thing. And it's been pretty well, apart from the big change that came in about 2013 when I did a big, really big redesign, they stayed much the same principles right the way through to then. And it wasn't until just before John became involved, who's a friend of Jeff's, who was the original, that's how they got to Austin, that I did all that work and changed the profile of the cases. They're still basically very, very similar, but the outside, the kinder curves and more sympathetic curves on them. And that's when I designed the new edging strip, the domes, which were about a couple of years before that, and which are the corner domes and the latch surrounds. And that perhaps brings us up to date with a lot of the case business. What up? Come on, ask me another.
Well, I have so many questions. Why did you know or think that glass fiber, or fiberglass as everyone calls it here, was the future? What was that from your boat days, that you saw how versatile it was?
Oh, yeah, I forgot, because I've always been interested in both. After we had the idea or rather, I had the idea of eventually of making the cases from fiberglass. I wanted to find out about it, and that's when I went and worked for SS Glass Fiber Designs, who made this little skitter boat, 14-foot boat in fiberglass. And I went there to learn about some of the principles of it, really. And I just had a well, I'd already cut the back off a sports car I had, or a special, which was and stuck another piece on with fiberglass. And I thought, this seems interesting stuff. And it's very malleable. You can do an awful lot with fiberglass. It has its limitations, but it has strengths as well. But I've so I thought that that would be the way of the future. Although it's fiberglass is fairly well established, and I've went in and worked on boats, and I love boats, so I've always had done. It runs back in the family to the 1500s. But so I enjoyed making boats, and they made me a charge hand and all that sort of stuff. And then I had to design a couple of little bits for them, and that helped me a lot in finding out what you can do with glass. And that was up to about the oil crisis of 73. But by that time, I'd already made the mold at home and the for the first one.
Yeah, so I was going to ask. So you made this mold for the first one, and then there must have, I'm assuming you used your own personal guitar, found some other guitars. There must have been some fine tuning that was done to make it work. I mean, how did you just come out of the gate with the design that ended up enduring for decades?
The first shape, well, guitars don't change shape.
No, I know.
So yeah. No, sorry, I'm not going to be better. No, guitar, so the cases really didn't. And the principle of having the shape of it was yeah, I suppose it's an established principle, but the first shape, which is basically the equivalent of the jumbo shape now that we produce all but it would you could put a D model in it, which is the most sort of common model, but it would take the J200. But it was in fact the new D model, I think the one we did and that Jeff's doing, was a bit larger because there wasn't enough padding really. But you could get a J200 in it, but basically most guitars were D models, and you pad them out to fit. And the height was, I miss, I no, there was, there were minor things, but basically that was the shape. And the shape of the lid, which is a compound curve, it's basically the same as if you look at a boat, if it looks good, it will sail well. And it's the same, almost the same. It looked as if it was going to be strong. If you press it in a certain way, it takes. It wasn't scientific, but it was what I thought would be strong, and it turned out to be strong, which was fortunate, really. So that was pretty well. That's a similar the shape of the current cases are very similar.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit more arch on as they've gone with every other case that I made. Because every time I made a new case, it was similar, but the style was the same.
And I can completely understand, as you just illustrated, the similarities between fiberglass on the hull of a boat and fiberglass around a guitar case. But that interior padding, was there a lot of trial and error to figure out the right amount of padding and something that you can add and subtract to accommodate all these different sizes? Did you have to go to a luggage company or something?
No, there wasn't anybody that was no, I basically you start I started from scratch. There's three different types, basically grades of foam that I used to use, and I imagine that Jeff's doing now. And that came fairly quickly. First of all, you try and buy it where you can, because I couldn't afford to buy from the converters, the people who convert a block of foam into sheets of foam. Basically, I started the A lot of the guitar, in prince, the case of principle, is the same as it was at the start. The shape to get the shape around the guitar, I would pad it out with strips that I would cut down with scissors and scallop off, and to get the shape. And we used to go to Cambridge Folk Festival every year and have a stand there, which was wonderful because all the musicians used to stop off, and we used to have good sessions there and things. And I could actually, I sometimes sold cases there and padded them out just behind the stand, and to fit their somebody's individual guitar, because like a Martin D model and a Gibson J45 may look slightly similar, but they are quite different. And the same is with the Guild, and other ones of the similar ilk. But basically, that's the way I did it first, then lifted up the foam and the velvet and put it back down over. But I haven't. A friend of mine suggested that I should bring the velvet in a different way, and I poo-pooed it in a way to him, and then he said, and it didn't wasn't till about a year later that I realized that he was bang on, and he said about how to cut the shape of it out, and then that's when I started gluing in blocks, and then cutting out the shape from there, which meant buying a very good carving knife and getting different ways of cutting it out, and then eventually I got a foam cutter, which I modified to get parallel to cut it out parallel, and that's what that and that hasn't changed very much. Running also where you pad to look after a guitar, it's basically a guitar is suspended in the case with the neck. Having a big pad on it, which it didn't have to start with, that did take a few years for me to think about. But to support your neck, have the neck clamped, and then the body supported under the heel of the neck, supported all the way around it, and then pads at the back end, the strong points of whatever instrument you're doing. So, like a banjo, which has got a solid tailpiece on it. You can put a pad straight down onto that, but with something like an arch top, you've got to have two big pads coming down from the lid, running either side of the bridge because it's a float. Sorry, the tailpiece because it's a floating tailpiece. Basically, you've got to keep the engine of the guitar, which is basically the table of the guitar, and you've got to, that's the engine. That's the bit that works. And you don't want to put any pressure on that, and certainly nothing on the bridge. And so many cases you see where you see marks in the lid where the bridge touches. Well, occasionally you may get this on our cases, but they are the main support is much further down, is onto the body, on strong points on the body. And the bodies are strong on guitars, especially around the tailpiece, which has got a big block under there, and a big, obviously, a block under the neck,
Sure.
where the neck joins the body.
Now, you've said you're making this sound easier than I think it would be for any of us to take some fiberglass and foam and build one of these. But B, you've made it sound like this was years in the making. All this while, did you know you were eventually going to start making guitar cases, or was this sort of a hobby at first?
No, this didn't take too long because I had the idea was in 1969, and the prototypes were out in the early 70s, but it was it, which I used it, found the base of it and everything. But I was doing other things as well. I was working with a boat company where there was so much demand at one period for many months. So I was working 10 hours a day. On the boats, 6 hours Saturday and 4 hours Sunday. It didn't see daylight for months in the winter, and I think I turned into a stick of celery, basically. But that from that, I managed to afford to buy my house, which was kind of important, which means that I could then have my own workshop. That happened in 1971. And once I had my own workshop, I then had control, a bit of control over my life. But bearing in mind, I didn't have very much money and behind me, and I didn't borrow. I didn't have a business plan per se. But I just managed to develop it as I went along. And I think, yeah, the first batch, I made about three cases, I think, one of which I still know the person who's got it. It's Major Damien Deaver. I think I mentioned that to you before. Yeah, Major Damien Deaver, who wrote the inimitable song, My Disused Buffalo Scrotum, which is worth looking up. It's a very sensitive song about not killing things for just and hanging them on the wall. I've got a lovely photograph of him and a case in the background on the table and on his, I think, 70th birthday, and a cake made to the same shape as the guitar case. And this was only a couple of years ago, which I did, in fact, send to Jeff. And that was in the very early 70s. And the other guy that was a guy called Diz Disley, who was brought Stefan Grappelli out of retirement, who's very famous, because Django Reinhardt obviously had died. Sure. And that he had one as well. And his quote was for me, four times around the world, my boy, and still going strong, which was nice. And that was, they kind of took off gently. And it's always the sales were always based on reference. I did add the only thing I advertised in right until its demise, sad demise, was something called Southern Rag, which became Folk Roots, which became Fruits, and eventually, like a lot of magazines, it couldn't keep going. And Ian Anderson was the guy who'd actually suggested in the cellar in Bristol in 1969, was the one who said, why don't you make something better than that? Can you do that? And which was the inspiration, because I was going to make car body parts before that, even though I was obviously involved with music at the time. That was the only advertising I did consistently right the way through until the magazine stopped. The odd occasional advertising, somebody with the odd magazine sometimes, but nothing consistently. Mostly I advertised in Fruits and Folk Roots was because it was a mate, you're trying to support somebody as well because they rely on advertising.
Sure.
Mostly it's word of mouth, and word of mouth is the slowest, but it's the most worthwhile form of advertising, really. Reference.
Yeah. Before these first clients got the cases, were you putting eggs in them or testing them and throwing them off buildings to make sure that your belief held true that this was going to protect guitars?
Yeah, you might stand on them a bit, but I don't. I couldn't afford to throw one. I couldn't even afford a case for myself, so I wasn't going to throw one off a building. But I knew that I could tell. You can tell whether it's going to be strong enough, this sort of thing. There were developments in like the edging strip in the early days, which was fairly. I think because they were still very pretty and this sort of thing, I sold a lot to classical guitar makers, particular one down in Assembly. There's a place down in the West Country that you can only get to. It's a bit like the village. What's that village in the film that only appears once every 100 years or something? And this village, if you can get to it, I remember going to his place, you have to do almost do circuits of the place. It's like you're in orbit until eventually somehow you find your way in. And then to get out, it's the same way as well. You drive around and you've no, I've never had any idea how I could got in and got out. But he would order six cases at a time, which was very nice and made it worthwhile going down there. I'm sure it was Semley. I can't remember the name of the guy. It's not a Rodriguez. He was a lovely maker, though. He came over to England from Spain as a painter and decorator after the war, I think. And then realized there was a demand for guitars, and he made classical guitars. some, I think Julian Bream played one. Julian Bream was a very famous classical player. And so I assume possibly Julian may have had one of my cases. I don't know. But how would I know?
Do you remember the first sort of bona fide music star to have one of your cases?
No, I think one of the Shadows had one over here. But I only heard about that secondhand. A lot of bluegrass musicians over in this country, and a lot of folk musicians, people like, it's word blindness. It'll have to come back to that one. I know Bela Fleck had one off me, but that was much later, and I got to know him a little bit. He's a very nice guy. And then he bought one for Earl Scruggs as a present, because he appreciated Earl Scruggs, and Earl was still alive then.
Sure. Well, that was going to be my next question. What was the second case shape, or what was the next variation?
It was probably the banjo, probably a banjo. I think a banjo and a mandolin were the next ones. And I did make a deep-bodied mandolin, which was difficult because it's the Italian bowl-back mandolin, and that's really difficult. I only ever made a few of them because obviously it's a very compound curve inside. But I made a couple of those, but then I made flat-back mandolins. Things like L4s and A4. What's the mandolin, the
there's
other?
There's an A style, there's A5, there's A3s.
A5s, F5s. And doing those, and made a few of those, and sold a lot into America at the time. I should have got my books out, because I still got all the books of all the sales from the early days. And American artists would quite often get them over here, get in touch with me beforehand, because my waiting lists were always quite long. And up to 1987, they would then call me or write to me or whatever, and we would I'd have one up ready for them when they came over. But that was the early days. Martin Carthy, that was it. You may know of his. Yeah, Martin, I think, had one of the early ones, and an awful lot of English folk musicians did. But I knew people because of playing on the scene in the 70s, and also knowing all the people, just meeting them. And I did sound for a lot of people as well, and also making cases. So everything I did was to do with music. Consequently, I'd meet everybody that on the scene, so to speak. So it was fairly. They knew me anyway, so they and it was nice. People trust you to do it, and they give you a shout when they need something. There's lots of other guys, but I find it difficult to remember sometimes.
No,
sorry.
That's okay.
I can blather.
No, you're doing great. So from the mid '70s, when you finally get these cases out into the world, or early '70s, to the mid '80s, was Carlton Cases just you in that workshop of the house you built, doing these one at a time by yourself?
Pretty well. And I'd occasionally have friends, musician friends, who'd come in there and spend some time if they were. The front room upstairs was the workshop for the lining, and outside in the garage, which started off a 16 by 8 foot garage, which then became 16 by 32. feet, and then it became a piece on the back of that, and then a piece on the front of that. And at one point I had so many shells made up, because the shells were relatively fast to make. I had so many shells, I'd make up all the shells for the orders, and I had backlogs of 6 months. And also, because there were recessions all the time, you get recessions and then reflation or whatever, This almost passed me by because of the buffer stock I had, and went through all recessions and didn't really have any downtime at all. But that's just, it's fortunate in some ways, and it's really nice that people were prepared to wait. And the other thing that has been nice in my life is that I've never had a bad debt. I've never don't owe people money, certainly, but people have never. Everybody has always paid in the end. Sometimes it's been difficult. A good pal of mine who was a guitar maker, he said he had real problems with money, but he was a great maker. I had to phone him. I said, "Look, I won't tell you his name." I said, "Look, mate, I know you owing money. It's like having money in the bank. But it's your bank and not mine." Mm-hmm. He paid. Of course, because these guys live hand to mouth, a lot of them, when they're starting up as well. We're all much the same. We all came up together. Because that was the burgeoning guitar making in luthier industry in this country.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and you never really, correct me if I'm wrong, but did you have much competition back in the 80s? Was it just those super heavy Mark Leaf cases that are take up the back of a pickup truck? Or
There was Mark Leaf, but I wasn't a great fan of his cases. He was in the States. There were a couple of people have come and gone on the way. And another friend of mine who's Hobgoblin Music, and I can say this, Pete McClelland, who was, he said every year, basically, he'd phone me up for a price list, as did Stefan Sobel, who's a wonderful maker over here and a great mate. And every year, both of them, over different time periods, would contact me to get a price list from me so that they could do the cases they were, in Stefan's case, he had a guy making cases for him in a pigsty next door or something, and he'd get them, he'd find the price list so they could find out how much he should be paying for his cases from this guy. And Pete McLennan, Hobgoblin Music, which is a great little folk company over here, lots of instruments, he had a little case company as well, and they would undercut me by a certain amount because they'd check on the price, what the going price was, and then undercut it. But they were not really bespoke cases. Well, Stefan's were for his own guitars, but the other guys, Pete McLennan and Hobgoblin, they were for sale in the shop, but they weren't really that strong. And they weren't custom made so much, but that's the only people that I can think of, really.
When you mentioned bespoke, it makes me think, or it makes me wonder, when someone would approach you for a case order, would they send you the dimensions of their particular guitar, or did you just sort of build out this reference library of, oh, he's got a 0028, which means it's this and this?
I had, by the time, as time went on, I built different size shells to accommodate up to certain instruments. And then you build up hundreds of patterns of different instruments that will fit into particular shells. About 20 different types of guitars with slight variations will fit into one shell. And you'll use that pattern to cut out the size of it, and then work out the angle under the neck and the places to support under the neck and the angle under the body to make sure that you can support it correctly. I had hundreds. I mean, Jeff's got hundreds of patterns now, and they're much, much better patterns than mine were. That's how you do it. Is that, sorry,
You totally answered it. And then my next question is just, I know sometime in the mid 80s there, you sort of, Carlton sort of had a presence in Canada in terms of being built there. How did that come about?
Oh, that was about 86, 87. Al contacted me saying he was coming over to England and he wanted to, he wanted to buy the shell of a case, of a base case for his base, and he'd been an upholsterer before that in one of his previous lives, and he asked could he have the kit for it and have a look how they were made and this sort of thing, and I said sure, and he came round, visited me, and we really hit it off very well. He had a very, very dry sense of humour, and we really took the mickey out of each other. We also both had the same sound rigs using Bose speakers, and were also, well, both bass players. Well, I played more guitar than bass, and same interests in music, the sort of old jug bandy stuff, older timey stuff, and general rock and roll stuff. And so he took the shell back to America and made up the case, and then thought to himself, I could make these over here. Because he knew that I had a real long backlog over here, and I was selling some cases into the States, I'd sell a batch over there or something. And so he organized himself. He had a workshop for some reason. I don't know why he had a workshop, but Michael Hayden, who's a great guitar maker, sure, in Calgary, was making at in part of his workshop. So Al decided to have me over there to or see if we could work out something, which we did. Because I couldn't keep up, I went over there with him for 10 days, and I got quite ill, and with a chest infection, which I used to get regularly because of working with fiberglass, but we basically set it up, and he knew how to do it. And him and Trudy, his wife, who is a lovely lady, they worked their nuts off, really, getting that going for the first few years. And they were supposed to be paying me on a percentage per case, a very small percentage, as it went on, because we never had it to climb with it. But it didn't matter, because the more they produced more and more over the years, so it made up for it. And which was handy for me. And any new cases that I made, any new designs, I'd make up a shell for him, and he'd pay to have it shipped over. And that's how we got the range over there. And he knew all the technology and all how to do it, and took him on and fine-tuned it over there. Produced great cases, very, very good businessman, and worked very fine margins. And did it. In fact, he worked a lot himself. He worked very hard to do that. From 1987 through to 2008.
Incredible. And then I know Carlton's had some kind of interesting history in North America. Now they're being made in Austin, Texas. What's your role today with Carlton?
Friend. Jeff, now, John originally came over to buy them in about 2012, 2013, had lots of interest, actually, and lots of people signed the non-disclosure agreement, came over and visited me, and some thought they didn't have the right situation or whatever. But John, who was the original guy, he came over and bought the company. Or arranged to buy the company, came over to and started producing in Jeff's workshops. And you, Jeff, and they got on and everything. Jeff is a very, very talented man, with not a background in music, although a music lover. He was a pattern maker and various many other things, a real bright man. But John eventually was finding it very difficult, because he always had another job. I think he was sort of poached, really, with making computer stuff, and he's a very skilled engineer. And eventually, he and Jeff came to an arrangement because they could, because John couldn't really keep it going and everything, and Jeff really realized that he probably could, and Jeff then concentrated full time on it, which is what he's been doing. But John was the initiator, and Jeff was carried it on. But both are great blokes, real. And Jeff is owns the company outright. I'm just a mate, and I'm very happy to chat to him about it. And I People ask me advice over here about and would like me to help them make cases, but I will tell them the basics. But although I'm not legally bound to, I don't tell people everything. Though you always help people along in business if you can. With like a guy I know over here wanted to have, he's just making some stuff in glass fiber, so I just described and my air-fed mask, which is basically uses vacuum cleaner hose, a hood that comes over your face, and a centrifugal pump that brings air out from outside, and that works. And it works for, I'd tell anybody that, because you want to protect people's lungs, because mine weren't originally. But yeah, Jeff's a mate. He's a very bright guy. I like him a lot. We have a nice time. Al, as you, Al Williams and Trudy, Al has now passed from us about a year back or something, and that was very hard. But fortunately, Jeff was managed to talk to him, and went up to see him, and they got on very well, which was good, because Al put a lot of effort into the company, establishing it in the States, and its consistency, and just work ethic was so good, and I was so very lucky to have met him, and that's wonderful. And I think everybody who's, and so many musicians in America and Canada will know Al to speak to, and Trudy. I actually don't know what the situation is with her, because she was suffering from Alzheimer's. But anyway.
And you today, are you just tinkering on new stuff, or what are you up to?
I did have a period of making a two-part dinghy, which I originally designed in 1980, but I didn't have the time or the money to carry it on. But I made the dinghy shell and the two halves, and one turns around and fits in the other. And it wasn't until after I sold the company that I then decided to, and I got another couple of hips, and I think I've run out of joints to replace now. And I thought, what can I work on when I'm standing up, so to speak? So I mounted this thing on, before I went into the hospital, I mounted it on legs, the dinghy, and bolted, and made a mold for the decks, and also the inner buoyancy chambers, and how to fit it together, and all this sort of thing, which kept me out of a bit of trouble for a while. And I got a really good review in Practical Boat Owner, and I've sold up to 25 boats now. And what you have to bear in mind is that up to includes the figure none. So basically I have this little third or fourth generation dinghy, which I strap onto the back of my bigger boat, and I love it. I just take it out and go sailing. So it was fun to produce, and it's got folding masts and folding boom and sprit and everything. It's an 8 foot long, and it's a doubles as a tender and that sort of thing. And then I had an idea at the end of last year to make fender hooks, little clips that fit on the either on the guard wire of a boat, to just two hooks that swivel on there that you can put to your fenders in, and also motorboat ones, which I've just developed in the last couple of months, which are go on 1-inch tube or 25mm stainless steel tube that you'd have around the side of, say, a motorboat, and you hang your these clip over and are fastened. And anybody interested, have a look at Calton Craft, my Facebook page, Calton Craft, it's on, or www.caltoncraft.co.uk. And I sell them all over the world. When we leave Brexit or whatever's going to happen now, God knows if anybody will be able to afford the tax to get them in their country. I don't know what it's going to be like. Oh dear, that's another story.
That is another story. Are you still playing music?
Very much so. I've actually got my first solo gig, well, whenever I want it. There's a local publican pal of mine has said, look, come and do a gig for us. And that is just rock and roll, blues, jazz, jive, comedy, smut, rockabilly, bluegrass, anything. And I said that a few times. I like playing, and I've just started learning harmonica, really. I used to play a bit of harmonica, but a friend of mine who wanted me to join him, his jug band in the early 70s, said, because I had a double bass. It didn't mean I could play it, but people assume that because you own something, you can play it, but I couldn't very well then. But he said, come and join this jug band. I said, okay. He said, the only condition is that you don't play harmonica. So that I didn't really do that for a while. But I think playing harmonica with playing guitar as well is quite useful, because it means I can do, I don't have to do too much in the way of solos, which I'm not that good at. But lots and lots of, most of my stuff is American music. Well, most of the world's music is American. Play a little bit of folk music and a lot of comedy stuff.
I love it, Keith. I want to hear your music, and I gotta look up these boat hooks, fender hooks.
Okay, that's smashing. Make what you can. And all right. My thanks go out to everybody who's been so nice in the last 50 years of doing this, and then I have met some absolutely wonderful people. It just comes to mind, John Sebastian. He's a lovely bloke. He came over to us on a stand when I went to Nashville with old Al in the early, when I took him a cello case over there, which we haven't really that you'd done many of. And his manager, he'd managed to send me a CD or something. And John came over to thank me. He said, thank you very much for making cases for protecting the instruments. I said, no, it's lovely. I said, well, thank you very much for sending the CD over. Your manager sent it over. He said, so he bloody should, he said. And John Sebastian, he's a great guy. He'll play in a pub with people just because he loves the music. That's the sort of people that we've got about. And that's what I've been so happy to be a part of over the years.
I love it. Thanks, Keith. Yeah.
You take care, mate.